This was once the richest part of the richest city in the Middle East. Now it's the front line of the war in the Lebanon. Buildings where last year the money makers of the Western world exchanged their millions are now the barricades of Beirut. The war has lasted 12 months. It has ruined a country and destroyed a nation. There is supposed to be a ceasefire in the Lebanon, but it means nothing. There have been 28 ceasefires, and each of them has been followed by even fiercer fighting. It's now a year since Lebanon's social tensions finally and inevitably exploded into war. Until last year, this corner of Beirut was crammed with clubs, bars, and brothels. Now the music stopped and the girls have fled. Instead, the streets shudder under shellfire, and snipers pick off the unwary with a single bullet. So far, the civil war has taken 17,000 lives. In the latest ceasefire, at least 50 and sometimes 100 people have died each day. The hotels which made Beirut the tourist center of the Middle East are now strategic forts, won in street by street, floor by floor battle.
War Chronicles by Joel M. Abiraker, MD, PhD. In recent years, we have witnessed with dismay how hospitals, which are supposed to be safe havens, have become tools of war, misery, and death, be it in Syria, Yemen, and other war-torn countries. But what does it mean to be a patient, a doctor, a nurse, or a student in a psychiatric hospital in the midst of a war? Here is the untold story of those who lived through the brutal civil war that engulfed Lebanon in the 1970s and lasted for 15 years. To quote the Athenian historian Thucydides, "All speculations I leave to other writers, whether lay or professional. For myself, I shall simply set down the nature of the plague and explain the symptoms by which perhaps it may be recognized by the student if it should ever break out again. The plague, in this case, is war itself." On 13th of April 1975, shots were fired from a car that killed a number of people during the consecration ceremony for a new church in Ain al-Rumaneh in East Beirut, attended by Pierre Jamael, leader of the Kataib, or Christian Party. A few hours later, the Kataib Mishelman retaliated by massacring all the Palestinian passengers of a bus returning to the Palestinian refugee camp of Tal al-Zatar from a commando parade in Beirut. The events that followed plunged Lebanon into darkness, chaos, and violence.
"I was operating on the Sabra line as bus driver. At about 12:30, some Palestinian fellows came to me to drive them to Tal el-Zatar camp. They got on the bus and I started driving toward Tal el-Zatar. When I got to the street between El Shia and Ain el-Rumaneh, in a place called El Imreya, I saw gunmen hiding behind a pole. As soon as I saw him, he opened fire at us. Then he stopped for 2 or 3 minutes, asked us to raise our hands. And as we did, they resumed firing at us. They emptied their bullets on us, and thank God, we stayed alive. Then the ambulance got there, picked the injured survivors, picked us up and moved us to the hospitals. 26 Palestinians were killed in the bus. And finally, Lebanon's war broke out on April 13, 1975.
A few months later, a psychiatrist who played a vital role in enhancing psychiatric training in Lebanon was kidnapped and taken to a Palestinian camp, which had become a zone of regular conflict between Christian right-wing militiamen and Palestinian fedayeen, as was the case with many of the other random sectarian-based abductions and murders, which had become frequent following the tragic events. The psychiatrist was kidnapped because he was Christian. Although he was released unharmed, the violence toward patients and the medical personnel intensified. At the Lebanon Hospital for Mental and Nervous Disorders, colloquially known as Esfurie, where the kidnapped physician worked, Muslim staff and students, especially the Palestinians among them, now feared reprisals and executions. There is an increasing feeling of insecurity amongst the Muslim staff, the medical director reported. It is worth noting that the hospitals located in a predominantly Christian area controlled by right-wing Christian militias in a sectarian war in which being a Christian or a Muslim on the wrong side of the conflict could be fatal. On the 5th of November 1975, armed and masked men from the right-wing Christian militia forced their way through the hospital barrier and kidnapped several students, among them Lebanese Muslim students and Palestinian students. This, the medical director reported, was a severe blow to the dignity and neutrality of a hospital, especially a charitable one like Esfurieh. Indeed, the mission of the hospital, which was founded towards the end of the 19th century, was to serve the poorest of the poor. The militiamen were avenging three of their partisans who had been kidnapped the day before. Although the students were released the following day, one Palestinian student suffered lacerations to the head, various bruises and cuts, and a broken arm. Injuries that were to become an all-too-normal manifestation of the brutality that was regularly inflicted on innocent civilians trapped on both sides of the conflict. The kidnappings included staff and students as well as prisoners from Esfurieh's forensic unit. Most of the inmates in that medical legal unit were being treated for substance abuse, to use the terminology of the day, though some ended up there for having committed a criminal offense while suffering from a mental disorder. On the 21st of January 1976, following a relatively quiet day, several armed men disarmed the gendarmes who were guarding the forensic unit and took away many prisoners, leaving the prisoners who were of the opposite religion in a state of panic. This time, as it turned out, the prisoners had been kidnapped by their own relatives. Ironically, the now former prisoners called the medical director to express their gratitude for the medical care they had received and to apologize to the psychiatrist for letting them down for reasons beyond their control. On the morning of the 14th of March 1976, armed men, among them former patients of the prison section of the forensic unit, took away several inmates after disarming the gendarmes. It is not clear if they had come to release friends and relatives or to exact revenge. It could have been both. A few days later, several armed men again attacked the prison section, this time freeing 30 prisoners. Later that day, still another group of armed men came and asked for the release of three specific prisoners, whom they named. The gendarmes, who by now were both helpless and hopeless, handed the prisoners over without any resistance. Several of the prisoners who were taken away that day were suffering from serious mental disorders. Although the local authorities were informed of the various infractions, they were utterly powerless. The country had plunged into total lawlessness. The same group of armed men visited the next day, saying that they wished to release another prisoner who was seriously ill, as well as three of those whom they had returned the day before. Again, the gendarme presented no opposition. The medical director tried to reason with them, to no avail. Their intention was clear. They were releasing Christian men who were being treated for drug addiction as a favor to their families. And they were kidnapping and killing Muslim patients, in retaliation for similar violence that had been perpetrated against their own partisans in Muslim-controlled areas. On the 18th of March 1976, three of the prisoners who had been released by the armed men were found dead, likely executed in cold blood. The next day, the tension outside the hospital was so hellish, with bombings, heavy shellings, and machine gun fire, that the psychiatrist had to increase the prescription of tranquilizers to calm both patients and staff. On the 20th of March, one of the prisoners who had been taken away by the armed men came back. He wanted to be readmitted to the forensic unit. The world outside the hospital seemed to him manifestly more insane. Baffled by this turn of events and unwilling to take any unnecessary additional risks, the gendarme refused to readmit him. The psychiatrist decided otherwise, taking pity on his miserable condition. A shell burst in front of the forensic unit in the early morning of the 25th of March 1976, causing substantial damage. The next day, heavy shelling injured a patient. 2 days later, one of the shells damaged the roof of one of the wards, killing one patient. By the 29th of March 1976, every one of the hospital's buildings had been hit at least once. The gendarme, now totally desperate, handed the keys of the forensic unit to the medical director and walked away. The continuous shelling and explosion caused heavy damage to the hospital, and the physical violence against the patients continued unabated, with more patients being killed, injured, or kidnapped. The militiamen had also started to violently assault female patients. Two of them were ill-treated by armed men, the medical director reported, and had evidence of trauma on their bodies. On the 6th of April 1976, three patients were injured and one killed amid intense shelling and bombing. A ceasefire later that day allowed the discharge of a few of the remaining patients, since it was becoming too dangerous to stay on the hospital's grounds. Their transport was a delicate affair. The Muslims among them had to be safely transferred to Muslim-controlled areas, and the Christians to Christian-controlled areas. In addition, patients who identified as Druze, Jewish, Buddhist, and atheists were also transferred. This moment marks the beginning of the disintegration of the pluralistic community that had, ironically, managed to provide a model of harmony and peace, in which diverse races, creeds, temperaments, and social conditions had coexisted for almost eight decades. The coexistence among sects that was now eroding on the national level managed to remain unscathed throughout the war at the hospital, though it was increasingly being tested. Anonymous callers made repeated phone calls in which they threatened various members of the staff. The medical director frequently met with staff and students to appease their anxieties and fears. He even wrote a letter of appreciation and gratitude in the hospital's newsletter, in which he praised their ethic of care, which placed the welfare of the patients above all personal, religious, and political considerations. Remarkably, the psychiatrists at S. Fourier continued to offer counseling at the dispensaries and outpatient clinics. The medical staff braved bullets and shells to provide these services free of charge to an increasingly nervous, anxious, and traumatized population that lived outside the walls of the hospital. Despite the sacrifices and courage displayed by the staff and administrators, rumors were now circulating that patients were being massacred. According to one newspaper, the hospital had failed to protect its patients from sectarian abductions and assassinations. It is true that the medical director and the staff mostly felt impotent and helpless. The belligerents rarely, if ever, took their opinion into consideration. It is also true that despite the killing and abductions of several patients, some had returned unharmed, and some had been safely returned to their families. But who to believe in times of war? As Fourier was not the only institution in the country, however, to suffer from abductions and assassinations, the American University of Beirut, with which S. Fourier shared long-lasting ties, also lost a large number of students and staff during the Civil War. In February 1976, two deans at AUB were assassinated. The dean of the School of Engineering, who was also a former member of S. Fourier's executive committee, and the dean of students. At least another 30 AUB students and staff were abducted during the war whose fates remain unknown. Acting President David Dodge was kidnapped in June 1982 and held for more than a year before being released, and Thomas M. Sutherland, Dean of Agriculture, was seized in June 1985, not to be set free for another 6 years. Perhaps the greatest blow to the cosmopolitan and liberal ethos of AUB, and of similar institutions such as S. Fourier, where people from different creeds and cultures worked and lived together, was the assassination of AUB President Malcolm Kerr in 1984. By an unidentified gunman who fired two bullets into Kerr's head while he was walking into his office. This excerpt is meant to be a testimony to all those who died, suffered, or survived during the long war years that traumatized generations of Lebanese citizens, including the author of this essay, who happened to study medicine during an era of political assassinations, impromptu terrorist attacks, and senseless violence inflicted on civilians.
Mercy, veni, povero, pia. Let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go.